Welcome back to the Lions Den. On today's episode, we speak to Jim O'Callaghan, a former rugby blue from Sydney, Sussex. Jim is now an elected politician in the Irish Parliament. Okay, so joining us on the line now is a very special guest. We have Mr. Jim O'Callaghan. Jim is a TD for Dublin Bay South, sitting in Dáil Éireann. For our English audience, that means he is a member of the Irish Parliament. But arguably more importantly, Jim previously in his life studied at Cambridge. He first of all did an LLM in law and then stayed on for an extra year doing an MPhil in criminology at Sydney, Sussex. And the reason why he's on our podcast today is because he used to be an avid rugby player. He played in two varsity matches for the Light Blues against Oxford. And he also went on to play for London Irish, Leinster and Connacht. And he was capped for Ireland at under 21 level. Jim, thank you very much for joining us at the moment. I imagine you're very busy at the moment, given everything that's going on in the world of politics at the moment. You're at home in Dublin, are you?
Yeah, I am, Nathan. First of all, thanks for inviting me to come on to your programme. Yeah, I am busy, like I suppose all politicians in Ireland or Britain or Northern Ireland indeed. People are busy with the pandemic. It's getting people down. But listen, there's light at the end of the tunnel. We're getting through it. People in the UK are probably a month or 6 weeks ahead of us in terms of vaccinations, but we're getting there as well. So, busy, but we're getting through a difficult time.
Yes, and the whole issue of the pandemic and easing restrictions, I'm sure that's something we're going to get onto later when we kind of talk about the sporting aspect. But let's kind of start with your Cambridge history. I mean, so I mentioned there you played in two varsity matches in rugby. What are your memories of those games, or just of playing rugby at Cambridge in general?
Oh, I have very good memories of it. Like I did, I studied law in UCD in Dublin for 3 years, and then coming near the, and whilst I was there, I played a lot of rugby in UCD, and when I was coming near the end of my 3 years study of law, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I applied to go over to Cambridge to do a master's in law. And I suppose part of the reason I applied to do that was I thought, if I got there, I might be able to play rugby there, known for playing rugby there. So I put in the application for the LLM. I got a conditional acceptance. And then I suppose after my final results came out in May or June, wherever it was, I found out, yeah, I'm going to get in. And at that stage, I went over to work in London. I worked on building sites for the summer there, but I didn't know how you accessed the varsity team in Cambridge. So I was playing in London Irish and somebody gave me the name of this guy, Tony Rogers. I'm sure people who are listening to this will know. So I rang him and said, listen, I'm an Irish guy. I had played for Ireland under 21 at that stage. I said, listen, I'm an Irish guy. I'm coming up to Cambridge in September. I'm interested in playing rugby. Can I play? And I remember his first question was, yeah, well, what size are you? was his first question. Which I suppose was a fairly incisive question since he knew I was a second row. So he got my vital statistics. And then he told me to come and join the team, which was going on a pre-season training camp in some place. I don't know where it is in Great Britain, but all I know it was called Borden. And I think it was a British Army camp somewhere. So like I was told to get to this place called Borden the following Thursday. And I managed to get there.
Fantastic. And did you win your varsity games?
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm going about this in a very long route. Then I suppose I got to meet the guys who were on the team, and a lot of them were very serious rugby players. You know, like I wouldn't have regarded myself, although I was a good rugby player, I didn't take it that seriously. I remember I arrived with a plastic bag. I was wearing a Leicester Tigers jersey, and all the other guys had these magnificent, you know, kit, like, you know, there were Welsh A internationals there. There were guys who played for England under 21. They looked the part completely. I didn't. But we hit it off. And then I managed to get into the team for the first match. There were a couple of second rows, I suppose, who were expected to get on the team. I got picked for the first match, which every season, I think, is against Cambridge Town. And I stayed on all the way until the varsity match. And that was our first varsity match. We were playing against Oxford at the time. They were the favourites, I would have thought, for that match. And we beat them. It was a good team. Alan Buzzell was the captain of Cambridge that year.
Okay, and then what about the second year? Did you win two in a row?
Second year, like, I suppose I enjoyed it so much. Like, I was doing a 1 year master's in law in LLM. I said, listen, this is great fun. We went on a tour to Japan in after that first season. In March, we went off to Japan for, I think, 3 weeks or something. We had a fantastic time. Then in the summer, I was invited to go on a trip out to India with the Penguins. So I went out to Calcutta, played rugby with a team I'd never heard of before, the Penguins in Calcutta. So, like, this chance, arrival into the Cambridge rugby network opened up all these opportunities for me to go to Japan, to go to Calcutta. I thought this was fantastic. I said, there's no way I'm going back to Dublin now immediately. So I frantically got out the prospectus for master's degrees in Cambridge. I tried to see what else was available that didn't involve having to do a PhD. And so, an MPhil in criminology. So overnight, I decided I had a passionate interest in criminology. And I got into it. It was a very interesting course. Enjoyed it immensely. But of course, it meant I could stay for another year, played more rugby. We had a second varsity match. And this year, we were the favourites for that varsity match. Our captain was Simon Holmes. I suppose one of the benefits also of being in Cambridge is I got to know Cumbria and the Lake District. We all went up to Simon Holmes' hometown of Cockermouth after the first match. But anyway, he was the captain. We were going to beat Oxford. They were falling apart because it had this internal row on their team at the time. They were captained by an Irish guy called Mark Egan. We were the big favourites. We went out to play against them and we lost. And none of us could believe it that we'd lost. Like, we'd had a fantastic season prior to that, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You talk about you got here and then decided to find a way of staying here. I'm sure there are plenty of sports people in Cambridge who can relate to that. I mean, I certainly can. I definitely decided to do a master's to try get another year of sport. You mentioned there, you kind of touched a little bit on kind of like the standard and how, you know, I mean, you said you'd already got your caps for Ireland under 21 and you might not have taken it as seriously. I'm curious as to, you know, comparing playing Cambridge rugby, because of course this was the heyday of the good old amateur days, of course, before 1995 and the switch to professionalism. I'm curious as to back then, before the game went pro, the club game at least, what was the difference in standard between possibly playing rugby here at Cambridge and then playing at other places, like playing at Leinster, playing at Connacht, playing at London Irish? Was there a significant difference?
There was a really high standard of rugby in Cambridge at that time. Like, prior to the varsity match, like, we would have played against Leicester, we would have played against Cardiff, we played against what was then, I think, Western Samoa. We hadn't had the reunification of Samoa at that stage. We played against Neath. We went down Wednesday evening, got the head kicked off us in Bridge End. Like, there were serious matches with serious teams. Like, every team we played would have a good few internationals on it. And, like, on the Cambridge team, we had a number of people who went on to become full internationals. I think Alan Buzza, Adrian Davies, Simon Holmes, Richard Poole-Jones. So, like, it was a really high quality of rugby, and it was probably considerably higher than the standard of rugby, I suppose, I had played prior to that, because my senior rugby had been played for University College Dublin, a high standard in the Leinster League, but this was a higher standard. And like, even if you look at the second varsity match we played in, what was it, the first one? Anyway, you had Brian Smith, who had played for Australia, Troy Coker, who played for Australia. Really high quality international players. And, like, although the game wasn't professional at that stage, we trained every day, sometimes twice a day. So it was professional without the money at that stage.
And then was it before or after that you played provincial stuff back home?
Then I came back. I played for Cambridge for 2 seasons. And obviously after the varsity match that time, I would go and I'd play for London Irish then. And then I came back. And I trained to be a barrister in Dublin, but, like, immediately upon coming back, I think in, like, the September or October, I was playing for Leinster, the provincial team. We were playing South of Scotland teams, played Australia. So I played for Leinster for a couple of seasons until I sort of didn't get any better, as they say, you know.
And I'd be remiss to not ask you this, considering where I'm from and being a Leinster fan. There's a big European semi-final coming up this weekend. This episode probably will go out after it, but, you know, you can look like a bit of a genius in terms of match predictions if you want. How do you see Leinster's La Rochelle game going this Sunday?
Oh, I think Leinster will win it. They're big hard club, La Rochelle, but Leinster are an exceptional team. You know, and I think back when I started playing with Leinster, you know, the game in Ireland at that stage was predominantly based on the clubs, okay? And when I was playing with Leinster, there was a coach there, Jim Glennon, and he was trying to say to us, listen, guys, we're going to try and develop this as Club Leinster, okay? People used to laugh at him, like, what are you talking about, Club Leinster? But they changed the transformation of Leinster from the mid-1990s to where it was, say, 15 years ago. It was a remarkable, quick transformation. It was just quite extraordinary. Listen, they're an exceptional team, Leinster. Like, when you look at how they put away Exeter, who are a fantastic team, like, that's a really good Leinster squad. And they have players in depth as well. You know, like, if a couple of people get injured, which used to be a problem for Irish teams previously, they have lots of more equally good players to take their place.
Yeah, I'm glad actually you kind of touched on the difference there between the size of playing for your province back when you played, and then maybe nowadays it's the trendy thing to do, and you know, you get 18,000 people a week in the RDS in Dublin watching Leinster, and that's a trend that's definitely followed over here. I mean, obviously the clubs over here, like you mentioned, you played against the likes of Leicester, etc. They probably had a little bit more history during the 90s and pre-professionalism than maybe, say, some of the provincial sides in Ireland did. But in general, there has been that trend, and professionalism seems to have been something that's been really good for the growth of rugby, and a hell of a lot more people will probably watch, particularly club rugby, now than they did back then. Does any part of you look back there and look at it now and think you would have had a lot of fun giving it a crack as a professional player if that opportunity had been available to you? Because obviously it wasn't.
Yeah, well, you're right. Like, I remember playing for Leinster against Munster or Leinster against Ulster, and there'd be around, I'd say, 4,000, 5,000 people at the match, you know? And that'd be a good turnout. Whereas now, Leinster against Munster will fill the Aviva. You'll get 50, 60,000 people at it. So the game has been transformed. But I suppose there were lots more people who went to watch club matches then, and they're probably not going to club matches now. They're going to Leinster games. But on top of that, I suppose the marketing of the game has opened it up to people who never went to matches before. Because I suppose it didn't really suit me time-wise. Like, the game went professional in 1995. I was around, 26 years of age at that time, you know. It wasn't a good age for me. I'd started working as a barrister. I'd been working as a barrister for 2 to 3 years. And like, I think probably, you know, just I probably hadn't taken the game seriously enough as well to make that transformation over to being a professional rugby player. And I didn't want to do it either. Actually, I never really wanted to be paid for playing rugby. Although I would have liked the intensity of the training. And I suppose the closest I probably got to professionalism was the 3 months, 4 months in advance of the varsity match, which was intense training, as I said to you, on a daily and sometimes twice daily basis.
Okay, well, let's change tack a little bit and talk a little bit more about the political side of your career. So now you've at home in Ireland, having won a seat in the last two general elections. You've now become this prominent politician in Fianna Fáil, particularly recently. I noticed that you made an appearance at an event at Sydney Sussex that got a lot of traction in the newspapers back home. We'll talk about that in a second. But you have this foot in both camps of politics and sport. And I think it's fair to say the pandemic has taught us a lot about how maybe we underestimated the importance of sport in society. I think people missed it when it was gone this time last year, a lot more than they realised. And as a result, it's been allowed to continue, or at least elite sport has been allowed to continue since August, give or take. So on this issue of the importance of sport to society, I wonder, you know, in your role as a politician, how do you see that and how do you measure that? Because, for example, I know you made the case recently for Leinster to run a pilot scheme where they could get, 2,000 fans in, and at some point at a game next month with antigen testing. So obviously, as a politician, you see this link between sport and society and politics, etc. And it's something that I'm guessing you believe strongly in.
Yeah, I do. And listen, like probably everyone, I sort of took sport for granted prior to the pandemic. Like, I used to just go running, I'd go to a gym now and again. But also I'd go to a lot of matches, watch my son play matches. I used to go to other matches. It's something we assumed would always be there. And when it was taken away from people, it had a very negative impact upon them. And whatever about, you know, been taken away from me. It wasn't really taken away from me other than as a spectator. But for, say, people your age or people who are engaged in sport, like, it's a huge loss, the fact that they missed out on over a year of serious competitive sport. And I know we've had exemptions for elite people. But, like, you know, that's time that people don't get back. Like, if I think back to when I went to Cambridge, if I had missed that, say, if there had been a pandemic in that year, whatever it was, 89 or 90, like, I wouldn't have just, those events wouldn't have been postponed for me. They would have been lost. I'd never have them. So, like, I suppose the difference between young people being affected by the pandemic and older people is that the former young people, you know, it's not issues that are paused, they're lost, okay? And I just think we need to recognize that. And obviously, listen, the pandemic is a very difficult issue to navigate, very dangerous for elderly people. You know, restrictions were required. And it was just a difficult, challenging issue for any government to deal with. But listen, I think sport is extremely important for the development of young people. Like, I suppose it makes you realize that, you know, there's much more to life than just existing. You have to get out and enjoy your life as much as possible. And I suppose the advantage or the fact about sport is that it's something really you can only do for an intensity while you're relatively young, you know? Like, you know, once you get to 30, 35, most people aren't going to be playing rugby matches or playing soccer matches seriously. So let's enjoy it. And I think there is, and I think governments do recognize the impact loss of sport has on young people. And of course, part of the things that concerned me was all the emphasis, Nathan, has been on preserving the what's referred to in Ireland as the elite sport, the professional game. And in my view, like, the other aspect of sport is probably more important. Sport for young kids, getting 5, 6, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds out playing rugby or Gaelic football or soccer, that's as important as keeping elite sportsmen playing. And I just thought maybe our emphasis should have been shared more on that than on simply preserving elite sports, you know?
Okay, that's interesting. That's interesting you say that the two are somewhat equal in your eyes, because one thing I was going to ask you is, what would you say to those people who maybe would be calling for grassroots sports to return sooner? For people who don't know, the Irish Taoiseach Micheál Martin went on television yesterday to confirm the reopening of Irish society, and grassroots sports is one of the first things to come back. But there are those who would say it should have come back sooner. And I'm curious by that point that you made, that you think it's just as important to the elite level. Do you think more could have been done then to bring sport back for everybody at sooner? Or do you think the balance between that and safety has been right?
Listen, it's a very difficult task for any government to navigate. And if it goes wrong, there are dire consequences for a government. Like, we look what's happening, unfortunately, in India at present, you can see what can happen when this goes badly wrong. So there are no easy solutions to it. But listen, you're right in terms of, but I think on the 10th of June now, matches can come back fully in Ireland, and probably going to be back earlier in the UK. But I suppose the concern they had, I suppose I emphasised as well, is that outdoor transmission is much less than indoor transmission of this virus. In fact, a report came out recently from one of the scientific organisations in Ireland saying that of all the cases in Ireland that were identified, only 0.1% of them were transmitted outdoors, okay? So that's an indication that outdoors is much safer than indoors. But I suppose the concern of the government and of public health advisors was that, okay, you have young kids playing sport, but I suppose the parents are going to be coming together, they're going to be congregating, kids are going to be traveling in cars with other families. So, like, it's not a simple issue, but I just think we need to, and I'm pleased Micheál has announced this, that we need to get sport back up and running for young people as soon as possible.
Okay, yeah, and it's interesting. Do you look, I mean, it's maybe a difficult question to ask, but as an Irish person who's come back to the UK quite recently, the difference between what I've been able to do in sporting terms is quite different. So you say that you think that sporting games might come back in the UK sooner. I can tell you they have. I've been playing cricket matches for the last month for the university, and I don't want to get into a game of necessarily comparing situations, because as you mentioned earlier, the UK is further ahead in its vaccine rollout, so it's probably not a fair comparison to make. But they're definitely, I mean, I can see it from people at home. There is a frustration maybe at home that maybe these events can't go ahead. Is that something that you can understand?
Yeah, people, listen. People understand that, and the government understands it as well, that people are frustrated. And like yesterday, it was a good day in terms of, like, there was the announcement of a significant lifting of the restrictions in early May, and then more of them being lifted in early June. But I suppose, you know, like, people are out there as we speak. There's people congregating. Young people are going to meet. You know, that's just the way it is. And I just think once we get organized sport back for them, it'll be better, because once people stop playing sport as well, it can be hard sometimes to get them in. And sport isn't just about, but irrespective of professional sport, it's not about sort of, you know, good, really good cricketers like you, or, you know, really strong young professional or rugby players who hope to become professional rugby players. It's just about getting people out playing matches, meeting people, socializing. Like, the big benefit I got out of sport isn't, like, is the people I met, is the entertainment I had, the enjoyment I got actually playing matches, the huge enjoyment I had after matches. So, you know, it's just, it's a whole range of architecture that's put in place by sport. And the pandemic made us realize how important it is to society. And, you know, we should need to try and protect it and nourish it.
By all means, and you're dead right. I mean, I'm as that, like I said, I'm not in Ireland at the moment, but even though I'm away, I could definitely tell the you can almost feel the national mood lift when the easing of restrictions was announced yesterday. And also, you paid me a massive compliment there by calling me a good cricketer. My recent performances would suggest.
I withdraw that comment.
Brilliant. The last thing I want to talk to you about was, I mean, we mentioned earlier you appeared on I wasn't at the event, but I'm assuming it was a Zoom event at your old college at Sydney Sussex a number of weeks ago, and the event kind of hit the headlines in the Irish press because you outlined your kind of ideas or plans for the very topical issue at the moment of the United Ireland question, and you outlined your various with the ways that you would include unionism in the process, etc. And like I said, it's something that's very topical. There was a big, I'm sure you watched it, there was a bit for our English audience, there was a big program on Irish television a few weeks ago where various political figures and sporting figures and figures from the arts went on the national broadcaster and discussed this issue. And one person who went on, and I found this really interesting, was a rugby player called Andrew Trimble, who played for Ireland, but he's from the north and was, you know, is very open about the fact that he was, you know, raised as a Protestant and with a British identity, but playing for Ireland because, of course, rugby in Ireland is an all-Ireland game. It includes both the North and the Republic. He was very open about his dual identity as a result of playing rugby. And I thought it was fascinating that it was sport that was the vehicle through which he has this dual identity. He identifies as both Irish and British. And I'm wondering, again, in your unique opinion of being both involved in sport and in politics, is there any rugby isn't the only sport that's an all-Ireland sport. You know, hockey is all-Ireland, cricket is all-Ireland, Olympians from the north get to choose whether they represent Ireland or Great Britain. All of this in mind, and it's a slightly long-winded way of asking, do you see any role for sport in this conversation that people are now having about identity?
Yeah, definitely. And like, just from my own experience as well, like, I've met so many great people from the what's referred to as the unionist tradition in Northern Ireland, and I've met them through rugby. You know, and if it had not been for rugby, I wouldn't have met them. But also that connection exists. Like, the national games here are a GAA. It's a 32-county game, and we have, you know, meetings of people through Northern Ireland and the rest of the country. Through GAA as well. So sport is a hugely powerful mechanism of enabling people to meet and to engage with each other. And like, after I came back from England to Ireland, like, obviously I played rugby here as well as provincial rugby, and once a month we'd be going up to Northern Ireland to play a match. And, you know, that was at the time as well when there was a lot of trouble in Northern Ireland. But it kept going, and people respected each other, people from different traditions. And, you know, like, politics can complicate issues as well and can complicate relationships. But like sport is a wonderful mechanism of meeting people and of just judging people. You judge people, but you judge them by their sporting ability or your camaraderie with them. And you don't judge them by their religion or their, you know, ethnicity or how, whether they claim to be British or Irish or issues like that, which is complex. But so, yeah, it's hugely beneficial on the island of Ireland. Rugby's been great in fostering engagement between the two jurisdictions on the island. And I think politicians have a lot to learn from it.
And in this wider question of either singular or dual identity and whether one of those identities or both of those are at threat with the United Ireland question, what effect do you think it has, somebody like Andrew Trimble, an international rugby player, going on TV and saying he feels both British and Irish? What effect do you think that has on the people watching?
Well, like, that didn't surprise me. And it's not for anyone else to define anyone else. But I know from playing rugby with people from Northern Ireland, or Ulster, as it's more commonly known. It's a provincial, nine-county provincial team, Ulster. But from talking and playing with people, you know that they're extremely proud to play for their Ulster club. They're even prouder to play for their Ulster province. But to play for Ireland is the greatest pride that can be got by them. So, like, there is a complexity there in terms of, you know, Irish identity. And, like, but, like, I don't know, I haven't met you before, Nathan, but, like, you will know that in Dublin as well, like, there are different identities and backgrounds of people in Ireland, which is Southern Ireland. But in Ireland, there are people who play cricket, there are people who play soccer, there's people who play GAA and hurling and, you know, rugby. So, like, all of them, and probably the reason why they play those games is because of either a family connection or a school connection, and based on a tradition which existed probably 100 years ago or something. And some, like, I played rugby, I had no family connection. My father was a fanatical Kerry man, a GAA supporter, but I just started playing rugby and I was good at it. So, like, people are open-minded as well, but, like, there's the traditions that are in Ireland are still there. As I look at you playing cricket, I played rugby, other people play Gaelic football. So it's complex, you know, and it's accommodating. And that's one of the great things about sport too.
For sure. I was really interested with the point you made there, that you think politicians have a lot to learn from that, and from almost like the simplicity of sport. I think that's a really nice way of putting it. Anyway, I've taken up more than enough of your time. Thank you very much for coming on and telling us about your memories of Cambridge, and also your thoughts on the role of sport in society. Thank you. Thanks very much for coming on, Jim.
Yeah, thanks very much, Nathan.
Thank you for listening to The Lion's Den. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow The Bluebird on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to keep up to date with the world of Cambridge sport.